This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. So glad to have you along today. We have talked on this show so much about the intractable problem of homelessness. Now Seattle has its first director of homelessness. George Scarola starts his new job today. And he told me his job is to carry out existing city policy on homelessness, not to redesign it. I asked him, what do you want to see happen with the jungle?
The mayor's been very clear that we could do a better job in our outreach efforts, but he's also clear about the direction, which is to help people move out of a very dangerous situation into stable housing with services. That's the right direction.
Mayor Murray told me we have the problem of too many homeless service programs working at cross purposes on their little piece of the problem. What will you do about that?
The goal is to help the city build a more efficient system that uses the talents and the resources in our nonprofit community to help more people.
That seems to have been hard to do so far. What can you do about that?
This is work that the city is engaged in, and particularly the Human Services Department. They have been working on this policy, and the goal here is to get alignment between the nonprofit community and the city on what are those benchmarks and how do we reach them better. Once that policy is clear, I think we'll see less rub, less friction. But this is the work of many departments, especially the Housing Service Department. My job is to carry out the policy, not to revisit it, not to design it. We have lots of experts, both in the city and the county and in the nonprofit community.
What is your take on how resistant some Seattle residents are to welcoming and helping homeless people in where they live?
Well, my take is that this is a generous city that just passed the largest affordable housing levy ever in our city's history, that it has made a large effort to make homeless people a priority across the community. That's what stands out to me, the generosity and the willingness to reach out to neighbors in need.
Do you have any personal experience with homelessness in your family or your circle of friends? Do you have a story to tell personally?
Yes, and almost every family does. We have good family friends whose son just decided that he's going to live in his car because he can't afford an apartment, much to his parents' consternation. Every family, almost every family, has somebody who's living at the margins, who may have a mental health or an emotional issue or an addiction issue. Some families have the ability to help that person through that crisis. Some families don't.
To a homeless person who hears, oh, there's a new czar or director of homelessness. That's after the one before that and the one before that. How will my life be any different?
That's the right question, and the goal is helping that person find stable housing and the services he or she needs as quickly as possible, and not let them linger in a system waiting for help.
Finally, George Scarola, do you want to ask anything now of the people who do have shelter, renters, homeowners in this city? What are you asking of us?
What we need to understand is that people who have reached homelessness need a hand up and need some help. And I think we're that's the kind of city we are. We're a compassionate city. So we need to provide that compassion to people who are struggling.
George Scarola is the brand new director of homelessness for the city of Seattle. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9, Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke, and in the news, astronomers have just announced they have found a planet orbiting the nearest star outside our solar system, and it's in that Goldilocks zone that they say about planets, where it's not too hot, not too cold, could have liquid water at the surface, maybe even life. And we're going to have a report for you this afternoon on KUOW WOW's All Things Considered. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Think you know downtown Seattle? Well, your knowledge will be tested this weekend with a scavenger hunt called Clue Quest Northwest. It sends groups of people with smartphones racing around the city answering questions. The inventor, a business analyst named Tim Ellis, says the questions make mental challenge fun.
They combine sort of puzzle solving and trivia and all kinds of stuff like that with exploring the city and finding kind of unique little spots around the city that you may have not seen before. And teams are going to get together and compete to see who can kind of solve all the clues and visit all the locations around Seattle the fastest and get back first.
If I want to get a team together, give me a picture. How is this going to work?
So the teams are 4 to 6 people, and sort of the clues are in two parts. They solve the first part, and it tells them what part of the city do you go to. You know, maybe an intersection or the name of a building or a landmark, that kind of thing. And then the second half of each clue is, you know, once you're there at that location, you're looking around at the environment, kind of figuring out where to go from there to find sort of this piece of information. And then that might be an engraving on a statue or a plaque or something like that, that some sort of permanent thing that's there that you need to write down information from to get their answer. So people are going to be solving all the first half of the clues and basically plotting their map, you know, through the city as far as where they're going to go, what order they're going to hit things in, and then they'll leave and run around the city and, you know, find all the answers and then get back.
People running around the city with smartphones. Is this Seattle's Pokemon Go?
You know, it's funny, actually. I was putting this together, and then I've run a couple of these for smaller groups, and then Pokemon Go came out, and it's having a lot of very similar effects. You know, people, yeah, getting out and about and kind of exploring places they may not have gone otherwise. So it's there are a lot of overlaps.
Now, some of these answers you've got to get by being in the location, but early on, you're asking stuff that I can look up on my phone. So what's one of those early questions, and we'll try this out?
So the answer to this is going to be a location in the city, and the question is, find the Seattle landmark that would be impossible to exist in Singapore since the medium of its creation was banned nationwide by a January 1992 law in the island nation.
The medium of this locate this landmark's creation. So I'm going to say, I'm typing into my phone, Singapore outlawed. You didn't say building material, but I'm going to start there. Building, you said medium creation, and I don't know if that's going to come out. Okay, so my phone's working on it. Control of asbestos in Singapore. 16 odd things that are illegal in Singapore. Asbestos came up first, but what landmark would get me to asbestos? I can't think of one. So I'm going to keep going down this list. Selling gum is the first thing. It's the gum wall at Pike Place Market.
You got it. That's, yep.
Okay. All right. I'm into it. Okay. So I would go to the gum wall and look for my next clue?
Right. So if after you solve that clue, the second part, once you're there at the gum wall, it's going to tell you something like, you know, in this particular case, it says, continue up the hill, turn left, head down the ramp to a landing, look for some unusual lamps, and that kind of thing. So it's visual cues that you're going to be able to see once you're physically there at the location that you can't really solve without going to it.
Is this just about running around and finding fun trivia, or is there more to it for you?
Well, for me, there's a little more to it in that the locations I send people to around the city are often places that they wouldn't necessarily even know existed before. I'm intentionally trying to pick places that are kind of interesting and unique. And, you know, I spend a lot of time when I put this together just walking around the city and spending as much time as I could kind of just exploring every little nook and cranny and finding interesting little features that you know, I overlook when I'm walking, you know, to and from work or to and from the bus or even just, you know, out to get lunch. And so it's a lot of the sort of the appeal to me is in exploring the city and finding, you know, kind of new things that you didn't know were there before.
Tim Ellis is the man behind the Clue Quest Northwest. And in case you were curious about Singapore's ban on gum, and I'm not saying you are, but if you were, you might be glad to know the story, which is that in 1992, the prime minister wanted to stop people leaving their chew all over the city's new railway. Thus the ban. If they just had a wall where they could stick the chewing gum, problem solved. We've solved that problem in Seattle. Anyway, the Clue Quest Northwest is happening this Saturday. We're tweeting out a link with information on how to sign up. This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Now for some more mental challenge that can be fun. I got into the news business really because of cartoons. That's where it started. As a child, I would read the newspaper with my mom and dad, and after I got done with the funnies, I would move over to the political cartoons. I was very happy to be reading what they were reading. I couldn't believe somebody was allowed to make the president of the United States look like that. It was subversive, and it was absurd, and yet it did look like Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. And as I got older, I just appreciated more and more how political cartoons can raise issues in a way that also hits you in the gut. And I found a kindred spirit in our next guest. University of Washington librarian Jessica Albano loves political cartoons so much that she and her team put together exhibits every 4 years showcasing cartoons about the presidential elections. Albano told me why she finds cartoons so powerful.
Within one single frame, a cartoonist is able to depict the issues that are happening and being discussed, the events that have occurred. It just takes a few brushstrokes and a few words, and you immediately get their biting criticism over what's happening in the world today.
Yeah, it can be hard to read a whole editorial, much less news coverage.
It takes a long time to read an editorial and really think about it, because they are complicated issues that people are describing. And so the cartoons to us are similar to watching like Samantha Bee Show or Stephen Colbert or The Daily Show. Those clips are so easily accessible, and you watch a few minutes and you get the point immediately. And cartoons are the same way. And we find them just as appealing to UW students as those sorts of videos that they're watching online to get their news.
It's such a tricky word, cartoons. To those who think silly, political cartoons are just such a craft.
Oh, definitely. I'm in awe. It's an art.
You've been watching political cartoons since around September 11, 2001?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. We get a lot of newspapers from around the world in our library collection, in Suslo Library. And right after 9/11, they started coming in. And they showed such poignant signs of empathy and sympathy towards what we were going through. Lots of tears on their national symbols in the cartoons. And so we wanted to show that on the display boards. And then we saw them changing. The focus of the cartoons started changing as we marched closer to war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And they started showing more fear and eventually hostility towards the United States over our actions and what we were doing. And it was just so wonderful to show that graphically, that in 2004, we were looking for an excuse to do another cartoon exhibit. And so we've done it for every presidential election since then.
You've brought with you a few favorites from this election season. Will you narrate a few?
Sure, of course. One that recently came out in August is from the Houston Chronicle by Nick Anderson. And it shows a woman with media written on her back of her dress. And she's pushing a baby carriage with a baby Donald Trump in there. And there's a gentleman passing by, and baby Trump says, "She's trying to destroy me." And the gentleman says, "Didn't she create you?" Which is just such a wonderful thing, because it's been amazing to watch Donald Trump get so much media attention and kind of take the oxygen out of the room, it seems like. I mean, he's dominating the cartoon landscape just like he's dominating the media airwaves from what we've seen. So I love this cartoon and how now he's mad that the media have kind of turned on him and they're starting to hold him accountable for what he's saying.
And what hits you right away in this cartoon is the caricature of Donald Trump as this orange-faced baby, which is a feature of this season. How do you caricature Donald Trump as a cartoonist?
Oh, they're doing it in lots of different ways. There's a lot of fun with his hair. It's usually crazy and flying away in the wind.
But isn't it so crazy that it's hard to caricature?
Well,
I mean, just Donald Trump in general. Do you find cartoonists struggling with that, or making hay, having a great time?
I think they're having a great time. I can't speak for them, but it looks like they're having a great time. They're having a great time with his physical appearance. I mean, his hands are tiny. He has a big old belly in a lot of them. And a lot of them just kind of creep us out, or like gross. I mean, there's been a lot of play with the Olympics and showing him as a diver and saying, if I don't win this race, the race is rigged, and, you know, plays on that. And I don't want to see Trump in a swim trunks, to be honest.
I'm sorry you had to see that.
Yeah, I am too. Yeah.
What's another cartoon for this season?
Okay, well, one about Hillary, because we really try to be fair and balanced in our displays. So there's one from the Arizona Republic from Steve Benson, and it's titled Hillary Rising. And it shows Hillary as a cross between a donkey and Pinocchio. And her nose is growing, but it's not growing straight out like Pinocchio's nose. It looks like a graph on an opinion poll. And it says, Americans think she's lying. And that's what a lot of the cartoons about Hillary have been about, her lying or her billionaire dollars that she's bringing in and her email scandal.
And how are cartoonists physically capturing Hillary?
Well, she's often likened to this donkey Pinocchio character, but she's also shown as just a small frumpy woman in frumpy pantsuits. She doesn't garner the same reaction or kind of the uncomfortable reaction in me that the Donald Trump cartoons get. Yeah. It's mostly her words and how they're accusing her of what she's doing that I find powerful.
You said you've been following political cartoons for years now. How are the cartoons from this election season different from campaigns past?
Well, the cartoons are similar in the way that they're critical and they highlight the candidates' flaws and use satire and humor, but they also seem different. And one of the reasons is there's just the sheer amount against one candidate. So it's Donald Trump just taking a lot of the attention. And even the cartoonists that over the past elections who have tended to lean a little bit more conservatively in what they were drawing, or it was kind of obvious they were more against the Democratic candidate, they're all critical of Donald Trump and what he's saying. And so the sheer numbers speak volumes. And some of them are depicted in ways I would have never really imagined a presidential candidate being depicted as. I mean, they're always harsh and in your face, but he's shown in very unflattering lights. I mean, he's shown as a bulldog. He's depicted as such a bully. And it's not really something I've seen before.
You're not just collecting election-related cartoons, you're picking up on lots of current events, the police violence, for example. Tell us about that.
Our primary focus is the presidential election, but it's impossible to ignore the events as they unfold. So the first event we started putting up when we started back in mid-June was the shootings at the nightclub in Orlando. And sometimes these things make their way into the political conversation and sometimes they don't. But we have one poster that we titled The Summer of 2016. And because it just has that vibe with the summer of 68. And so we're highlighting Black Lives Matter and the police shootings. And some of those are the most impactful because you expect a cartoon to be funny and happy, but biting. But these are just sad and heartbreaking.
What's one of those cartoons?
So this one is from the Miami Herald, Jim Morin from July 8th. And the title is We Had Better Overcome. And it's a white policeman and a black man. And the policeman is holding his hat in his hand and they're arm in arm. And the black man has a Black Lives Matter T-shirt on and they're both shedding a tear. And so the only words are we had better overcome. But it says so much. It's like we need to address this and overcome this or we're really going to hurt in the future.
That poignancy and that, in a way, simplicity, together, apart, it just is perfect for a political cartoon.
Definitely.
Jessica, you and I have been bonding over how much we both love editorial cartoons, and I have since I was a child. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Why do these cartoons matter so much?
I think they matter because they represent our history and what we're experiencing today in a graphical, powerful, biting way. And something about graphics or visual, even though it's a still image, still resonates so deeply. And it's just an amazing art form that with just such few words, they can say so much. And they either appeal to us because we really agree with them, or we might really disagree, and then it makes us really angry. But either way, we want to show them to our friends.
University of Washington librarian Jessica Albano telling you about this current collection of cartoons, which you can see at the Suzzolo Library on the UW campus in Seattle. They've got cartoons from papers all over the country, and they're adding new ones every day. Jessica says she hopes the exhibit will spark conversation, and more than that, that they will encourage Husky students to vote. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. When I go to my sister's house on Vashon Island in the summertime, I love to gather blackberries because they're in her yard and not mine. In my yard, blackberries are a wrestling match, and very possibly your yard too, because blackberries are just about every place in the Puget Sound region. Most prevalent is your Himalayan blackberry. That prevalence prompted a question for KUOW's Local Wonder Project.
This is Eric Sochet from Snohomish. While traveling in the Himalaya, I never saw any blackberry bushes. Where did our invasive variety originate? When and how did they get here?
Eric, good point, good question. We sent out KUOW reporter Ann Dornfeld to answer you.
Growing up in Seattle, I spent summer evenings like this one picking blackberries. These days, I spend more time trying to fend off blackberry vines in my garden. If you've ever tried to do that, you've probably found that trying to follow one long blackberry vine to its source leads to another one heading a different direction. Kind of like the story I'm about to tell you.
It was the end of the 19th century, and American life was changing dramatically. People were moving from rural areas to towns and cities, including Seattle. Industrialization was creating a new middle class. Meanwhile, way down the coast in Santa Rosa, California, an eccentric guy named Luther Burbank was hard at work on his experimental farm. At the turn of the century, scientists were just beginning to understand how heredity worked. Burbank didn't have any formal training, but he was working feverishly to breed strange and wonderful new kinds of plants.
He realizes the growing middle class is going to want to have fresh fruits and vegetables. They're not going to want to eat canned beans. They're going to want to be able to eat fresh beans all the time. But in order to do that, they're going to have to be able to be shipped.
Philip Thurtle teaches the comparative history of ideas at the University of Washington. He says Burbank set out to create new varieties of fruits and vegetables that would be delicious and prolific, and that could withstand the voyage on the nation's new transcontinental railroad. Burbank sold his hundreds of plant creations through catalogs with pictures of shiny fruit and shinier superlatives.
A new cherry, the Burbank. The earliest of all large cherries, the largest of all early cherries, and not only the best of all early cherries, but unsurpassed by any cherry of any season.
Burbank's inventions could be weird, like a spineless cactus, or his potato-tomato hybrid, which somehow never took off. But others were smash hits. He created the Freestone peach, an elephant garlic.
My favorite the example is the Shasta daisy, because this is something that most of us have in our gardens.
Chances are you've eaten one of Burbank's creations if you've ever had fries at McDonald's. He made his money on a potato he invented in the 1880s he called the Russet Burbank that's the most widely grown potato in America today. Thurtle says around the same time, Burbank was working on a new large-scale project.
And that was to create a thornless blackberry, you know, kind of the parallel to his spineless cactus or his stoneless plum. He kind of wanted to take all the rough spots out of nature to domesticate it for middle-class lives.
Burbank traded seeds with fellow collectors all around the world. In a package from India, he found seeds for a huge blackberry with an even bigger flavor. Burbank named it
the Himalaya Giant,
even though it's actually thought to be from Armenia. Burbank found that the Himalaya Giant grew like nobody's business, but only in temperate areas like the Pacific Coast. In 1894, he offered the berry in a special catalog he sent buyers in mild climates. It was popular. By the early 1900s, the Himalaya Giant, which we now call the Himalayan Blackberry, was especially thriving in Puget Sound. Thurtle says Burbank's business was thriving too. Everyone wanted to see his famous plant laboratory. He was hanging out with Thomas Edison and Henry Ford.
So he's an international celebrity.
Burbank was so successful at breeding plants that he became interested in applying the same principles to people. He started selling a new book he'd written in his catalogs called The Training of the Human Plant.
When all the necessary crossing has been done, then comes the work of elimination, the work of refining. Until we shall get an ultimate product that should be the finest race ever known.
Burbank considered the U.S. the perfect eugenics opportunity because at the turn of the century, there were immigrants coming from every part of the world.
Look at the material on which to draw. Here is the North, powerful, virile, aggressive, blended with the luxurious, easy-loving, more impetuous South, the union of great native mental strength, developed or undeveloped, with bodily vigor, but with inferior mind.
Burbank had a theory that an organism's surroundings left an imprint that was passed on to future generations. So he wrote that children should spend most of their time outdoors, communing with nature. Perhaps that's why a Mercer Island boarding school for troubled boys was named after him in 1931. Seattle boys running amok were sent to the Luther Burbank School on the shores of Lake Washington, where they learned to farm. Today, only the dormitory remains in what is now Luther Burbank Park. And the only thing running amok at this park are the Himalayan blackberries that escaped those turn-of-the-century berry farms and gardens.
I mean, there is not a part of Western Washington that is not touched by this plant.
Sasha Shaw is a noxious weed expert with King County. She says the blackberries crowd out native species of plants and animals.
It is successful in our entire region. It can grow in dry soils, wet soils. It grows into the forest. It grows in full sun. There's really not a place it can't succeed.
Birds and other animals spread the seeds far and wide, and once the plant is growing, when the tip of a vine touches the ground, it can create a new plant.
Very aggressive. People try to kill it. It just keeps coming back. I mean, it has really everything going for it in terms of an invasive plant.
Luther Burbank never got around to breeding humans, but it seems as though he may have introduced a master race of berries. In Mercer Island, I'm Ann Dornfeld for KUOW's Local Wonder.
That story was inspired by a perceptive question from a listener named Eric Soche. And, you know, we mentioned gathering blackberries in the yard. If you do have a yard full of blackberries, what do? Obviously, you make a pie. We have recipes at KUOW.org. The reporter on that story, Ann Dornfeld, claims to have the best blackberry pie recipe. We're not sure. Much as we love Ann, possibly our listeners can top that, and it's a challenge. Our listeners can go to KUOW.org, and you can tell us how you use blackberries. Send us a recipe or take a photo. Describe all its glory. You can email to record@KUOW.org. While you're there, leave us your local wonder about the Puget Sound area, and if your question is selected, a KUOW reporter will investigate. Okay, so blackberries are everywhere in Seattle right now. Here's something else that's all around Seattle. That is teriyaki. You know teriyaki, right? Mounds of pillowy white rice, chicken smothered in sweet brown sticky sauce, and a side of iceberg lettuce. Pass by any strip mall or street corner in the Seattle area, you'll probably see a teriyaki restaurant. But it might not always be that way. Writer Naomi Tomke says Seattle's teriyaki joints are disappearing, which is costing us a uniquely local institution. Tomke says the teriyaki entree was invented here, something she didn't realize until 2007 when she read a Seattle Weekly article chronicling teriyaki history.
I decided I wanted to do some more research and write my own history of it as a native, as somebody who grew up eating it, as somebody whose high school lunches were at Yasuko's on Broadway. And as I started to look into it, Yasuko's on Broadway had just closed either earlier this year or the end of last year. And as I looked at the numbers and looked at where teriyaki was going, it became not so much a history of teriyaki, but a story about teriyaki and where it is now, which is declining.
Where are we seeing the biggest teriyaki losses?
I mean, it's everywhere that there's a lot of new construction. So Yasuko's closed on Broadway, where you have the streetcar coming in and all of these new construction buildings. I think Ballard is another big one where you have a lot of big new construction condo buildings going in. A lot of what teriyaki is these small little hole in the walls. And so as those disappear from the city, from the landscape in general, that's where we're losing the teriyaki shops.
You suggested that teriyaki places are closing with all the newcomers, but what's the connection? Why are teriyaki places less popular, if they are, or just less numerous?
So I think it's twofold. One is that teriyaki isn't like it is in Seattle anywhere else. So people aren't coming in here and saying, hey, I really miss my teriyaki shop back home. Where can I find my local teriyaki shop here, the way they might for a taco shop or for an Italian restaurant, a pizza place, even a hot dog. They have their places at home, and now they want to find their Seattle replacement. Well, teriyaki doesn't exist like this anywhere else, so they're not going to be looking for that replacement. The other piece of that is that teriyaki restaurants are a little bit, not necessarily hidden, but they're not appealing. They don't have a lot of curb appeal. Knut Berger mentioned in the New York Times article, if you're a newcomer to the city and you walk down a block and there's an Ethan Stoll pizza restaurant and, you know, a Tom Douglas restaurant, and then there's a hole-in-the-wall teriyaki shop, and you have the means to pay for that pizza or at the Tom Douglas restaurant, you're not going to choose the teriyaki shop. It's probably dingy. There's probably sauce stains on the walls.
Why is that, though? Why aren't teriyaki places fancy? Why are they holes in the wall?
Well, because part of the appeal of teriyaki is that it is eminently affordable. I always use the example of Dollar Rice, which Yasuko's on Broadway served when I was in high school, and we would pay $1 and they would give you a styrofoam container just full of the rice from the teriyaki shop and then with the sauce on top, and it had some little bits of meat. But it was $1 and it was enough rice to last at least two meals. And we as high school students thought that was a great deal for lunch. It was probably the only thing that cost as little as school lunch. But, you know, the people who lived on the street on Broadway wanted a $1 meal, too. The people who were college students at Seattle U did.
And even the full-on chicken meals are big portions.
They're probably, you know, $5 to $10 and at least two meals worth of food. And so I think that's a big part of, you know, if you can afford something else, that's not where you're going to go. But if that's all you can afford, it really kind of occupies a place in your heart.
You said people who come here didn't have teriyaki back home. It was kind of reinvented here. What's the teriyaki story of Seattle?
Yeah. So Toshi, who you've seen his name on signs everywhere.
Many, many stores.
So he basically invented what we think in Seattle of as teriyaki. Teriyaki is a sauce that they use in Japan. It's mostly used on fish. It's like a post-grilling glaze. He came to Seattle after he finished school in Portland. He'd come from Japan to wrestle in Portland, and all his friends owned restaurants, and he wanted one too, but he didn't want to have to deal with managing people and worrying about everybody showing up to work and what would he do if someone didn't come. So he wanted to make something that he could do on his own. So he took this sort of inspiration from Japan and made it into this marinated grilled chicken and served it up with big piles of rice and a little bit of what he called coleslaw. And that was sort of the birth of teriyaki. That was 1976. It got reviewed in the Seattle Times. People started lining up. He opened a second store. He eventually branched out and franchised all over the city, which is why you see so many things called Toshis that aren't necessarily related to him. And then the franchisees opened new shops and they all sort of did a spin. So there was Toshios and Yoshis and all sorts of different takeoffs on that.
And you think there's something about teriyaki that captures a bit of Seattle?
I do. I think Seattle has a unique position in the U.S. in that it faces much more towards Asia than it does towards Europe or even along the southern border towards Mexico. And it has its own spirit. And I think that spirit, teriyaki, takes something that was truly Seattle but inspired by Asia and makes it our own. It's also something that fits in on the street in Seattle, or at least it did in the Seattle that we grew up in that it came from these small little hole in the walls in the neighborhoods. And in the way that Seattle is really a city of neighborhoods, everybody had their neighborhood teriyaki shop. And so I think that kind of all played in a little bit to making it a uniquely Seattle dish and the restaurant itself a uniquely Seattle construct.
You know, Naomi, I've got to take some of the blame here because honestly, I find teriyaki, I find the glaze too sweet. I find the chicken is not that interesting, but I won't cover up the mild flavor of salmon with that strong sauce, so I don't do teriyaki salmon. What am I missing? Because you seem to love it.
So, I mean, I think there's two pieces to that. And the first is there's a lot of bad teriyaki now. When I spoke with Toshi, this is one of the things he said, is that he goes out and he tastes what people are making and they haven't marinated the chicken and they've pre-cooked it and then they just throw it on the grill really quickly and serve it as the customer wants it. at his place up in Mill Creek that he's cooking at now, it takes a little while to get your food because they're making it when you order it. And I do think that that's some of it, is there's a lot of really bad, unsubtle teriyaki out there. And so people don't get it because that's what they try.
So I'm not just being disloyal to Seattle?
Not being disloyal to Seattle. I think the other thing is, it's one of those things, people who grew up eating, you know, menudo or tripa alla romana love tripe. It is their comfort food. And if somebody tries it as an adult, they're probably going, really? This is what you want when you're missing home? And I think that to some extent, teriyaki is that for Seattleites. I think it tastes great. I think without some of that emotional attachment, it might, you know, be just fried chicken or something else that's good, but doesn't have sort of that emotional pull.
Is another reason Seattle isn't famous for teriyaki that outsiders seem to know us through award-winning chefs using fresh, locally sprouted ingredients, and they write beautiful cookbooks and have big, open, airy new restaurants?
I think that some of the allure of Seattle is that it is positioned on this gorgeous waterfront, and you have these fresh seafood boats coming in, bringing in salmon and oysters and all of this gorgeous fresh food. And you have these amazing chefs. You have Tom Douglas, Ethan Stoll, you have Jason Stratton, you have these people doing amazing stuff with it. And I love that part of Seattle. I love all of Seattle. But what outsiders, what people moving here see is that. They don't move here and go, oh man, I can't wait to find the $5 teriyaki that's going to be next door to my house. But I think that they can both live side by side. I think that we have sort of a dual personality, and everywhere does. The Philly cheesesteak, the Chicago dog, these places all have wonderful high-end chefs that you hear about. But somehow their underdog dish also gets talked about, and I think that it would not be inappropriate for teriyaki to take that place in Seattle.
Why do you root for this underdog dish? What would we lose if teriyaki kept on fading?
Well, we would lose teriyaki, which to me is very sad.
Well, there's never going to be zero teriyaki, but you seem to want it to have that Philly cheesesteak kind of status.
I think having grown up in Seattle, it holds that piece of my heart and that piece of old Seattle. It represents the Seattle I grew up in. And yeah, I think that part of it is that I feel that Seattle is changing, and I love the Seattle that I live in today as much as I love the one that I grew up in the 80s. But that would be a piece of the old Seattle I would be very sorry to see go. In the piece, I referenced The Kingdom and Kurt Cobain. And to me, it's a little bit like this is the last piece that's still here from 1980s Seattle. And it's a piece that we can hold on to. And also, it's a piece that tastes really good.
Naomi, what are we going to do to boost teriyaki?
We are going to eat teriyaki. It's a tough job.
Especially at the not so tough in the restaurants that do it well.
That's
so hold
right.
them. We got to hold them to that standard, right?
That's
we
right.
We got to eat it and critique it.
I think, you know, when you find a good teriyaki shop, talk about it. Tell your friends. Tweet about it. I think that we have to take teriyaki from being that thing that you eat when, oh my God, you can't find anything else and you got to find your meal with the money you found in your couch cushions, to something that we are telling our friends when we found something good.
Can it happen? Do you think teriyaki is going to rebound and be that Chicago deep dish Philly cheesesteak thing?
I hope so. I don't think it's impossible.
We are tweeting about it. That's food and travel writer Naomi Tomke. Her article on teriyaki appeared in Thrillist, and it's being tweeted at KUOW. She blogs at The Gastronome. In 1970, Lolita, the orca, was taken from Puget Sound and put in a tank at the Miami Seaquarium, where she's been ever since. A judge has ruled against advocates who want Lolita freed. But last week, disturbing court documents about Lolita's living conditions were unsealed. The director of the Orca Network, Howard Garrett, has been fighting for Lolita's release for years. Even he was surprised by some of the new details, particularly that the dolphins Lolita is penned with abuse and assault her.
That's a big revelation. I didn't know that they were harassing her constantly and raking her and biting her. And
is that well known, that dolphins and orcas don't get along, or is this its own thing?
That is the only place. In the Seaquarium, they brag about that it's the only place that you will see dolphins and killer whales in the same tank. So I don't know that it happens anywhere else. But what I have seen in the wild up here off San Juan Island is occasionally some Pacific white-sided dolphins, the exact same species as those in Miami, have come in and harassed some of the southern residents. You can see it. They kind of dive bomb them and pick at them, and you can see the orcas trying to do some sort of evasive moves and try to kind of slap them away, but it's like crows harassing an eagle. And they just can't make them go away. So I've seen that in the wild, but I didn't know how it happened there in Miami.
A federal judge had already ruled in favor of the Miami Seaquarium keeping Lolita. Do you think the release of these court documents changes anything?
Yes, I do think that the release of that kind of information, these damning revelations, is going to weigh in on the appeal. Now it's general knowledge, and that sort of changes the whole atmosphere of the decision-making when the public understands this information.
What do you say when people in the public say Lolita belongs where she can be cared for and we can enjoy her and she's an inspiration and an education to us all?
Well, I think that is the argument that we've been hearing for decades, but these reports reveal that she is under constant stress. She is being medicated sporadically but repeatedly for all sorts of stresses, for ulcers, for low-level infections, for abrasions, for lesions, for attacks, rakes, and bites from the dolphins. She's not happy there, and she is not a good performer. She's very sluggish. She sometimes refuses. She does a lot of what they call precursors of aggression. All of that indicates severe stress. It's just a miracle that she's still alive.
Is there a way for us to enjoy orcas in captivity in a humane way?
I don't see any way to keep an orca in a concrete box like that and have it enjoyable. The public now knows that it constitutes animal abuse, that any orcas or dolphins in a concrete box like that cannot be thriving, cannot be doing well. You know, they barely survive. And I think that changes the whole atmosphere of going there. You know, it goes from being family fun and it's sold as conservation and education, and now people are seeing, but the animals are suffering. And that changes the whole atmosphere of seeing that.
SeaWorld has been moving away from marine shows, saying they're reflecting a change in public tastes. Is the free market taking care of this?
The free market is taking care of this, and that's due to an increasingly informed public. People are now aware of what's going on with the animals, what the captivity effects are on those animals, and so they're staying away in droves, and that is the free market at work, and I think that is what is going to change the business model.
Howard, will you live to see Lolita freed?
If you'd asked me 2 or 3 years ago, I'd have said, well, I can only hope. But as I see public opinion shifting so fast and so many people, professionals, from attorneys to publicists to all sorts of people who have real influence in the agencies and in the business world begin to understand and turn their opinions sooner or later, and I think it's going to be sooner than later, there's going to be a tipping point where they're going to say, okay, to preserve their own reputations, their own business images, they have got to begin to let those whales and dolphins have their freedom.
Howard Garrett, director of the Orca Network, telling you about court documents in which Lolita's dolphin roommates don't come off well. Which brings us to Hawaii, where federal regulators this week say they want to protect spinner dolphins by banning tourists from swimming with them. National Marine Fisheries Service worker Ann Garrett says it wears the dolphins out.
Not getting enough rest is much like us. If we don't get enough rest, we can have health problems. We get increasingly sick, and we can't function as well as we could with a good night's sleep. The same with the dolphin.
In fact, it's worse because these spinner dolphins are nocturnal. They need to rest during the day.
So over time, their health may be impacted. They may not nurture their young as well. They may abandon their young. They may abandon their habitat. And they may suffer long-term population-level impacts.
Hawaiian tour companies with names like Dolphins and You object to the proposed ban. This is KUOW's The Record. Even more than Seattle, the housing market in Vancouver, B.C. is hot, but cooling off now. Here to tell you why is Stephen Quinn, host of CBC Radio's On the Coast.
Zolo, which is a national real estate brokerage firm, says that the average price of homes sold in Vancouver, in the city of Vancouver, over the last 28 days has fallen by about 21.4%. So that's the price. But when you compare it with a year ago, prices are down by just about 7.5%. I guess it's significant because nobody around here is used to the prices doing anything but increase in the double digits year over year. What is really interesting are the number of sales. They've tanked. There's new data out today from the Real Estate Board of Greater Vancouver that shows the number of single-family detached homes sold in the first 2 weeks of this month, and it's a short period of time, but down by 66% over the same period last year, and condos and apartment sales have dropped by about 42%. So we are seeing the prices drop a little bit. We're seeing home sales, though, really slowing down.
How much credit goes to something we've talked about before on this show a couple of times, the tax on foreign buyers?
A lot of people blaming the foreign buyer tax. If you're not a Canadian citizen or a permanent resident, you pay an additional property transfer tax of 15%. That's a lot of money.
And that's as of just a few weeks ago,
that's right? As of the beginning of the month, yeah. The provincial government started collecting data on foreign ownership a while ago. They were really responding to this public outcry that somehow foreign investors were really skewing the Vancouver real estate market. Everybody thought that was plainly obvious. They were demanding that the provincial government do something about it. And so seemingly out of nowhere, the provincial government introduces this 15% tax. And what we have now, we think, is a lot of people waiting on the sidelines to see where this is going to go. So that would explain the big drop in the number of transactions right now. The market, though, was already starting to cool off even before that tax was introduced. So to what degree that tax has affected the wider market, it still isn't really known.
How is this affecting people in Vancouver? What are they saying about it?
You know, I would love to jump to the conclusion that housing is suddenly going to become affordable in the city, but because if foreign buyers go away, obviously, then the reality of local supply and demand kicks in here, which means we will see prices, you know, come down. Right now, I think the figure is the average house in Vancouver costs 21 times the average annual income around here. Nobody's talking about a crash, though, at this stage. Everybody's talking about an adjustment and really, you know, maybe introducing some sanity to the market. For people who own their own homes, who bought a long time ago and have, you know, just been breathing in and out over the last 10 years and become millionaires by doing it, they could see that value drop substantially. But even if the house value dropped by 20%, you know, they're still up exponentially from where they would have been if they bought the house 2 decades ago.
Of course, there are winners and losers. Is there a backlash against this new tax on foreign buyers?
Well, you know, there is. And it's interesting because there was a real public demand that the government do something about it. And now it looks like, you know, they've done it. They've managed to somehow introduce something that feels like it's cooling the market down. Anyhow, there was a lot of animosity directed at foreign buyers as well. And a lot of people will tell you animosity, you know, verging on racism, because a lot of people blaming Chinese money for this. Almost universally, everybody hates the way the tax was implemented. It came without warning. There was basically a 2 or 3 day notice given. And people who were in the middle of transactions that hadn't yet closed were going to be subject to the tax if they didn't close by the date that the tax was introduced. I talked to a young guy from California. He's an animator. He's been working here in Vancouver for 2 years. He's applied for permanent residency. He's just waiting for that to happen. His agent called him up and said, you know, the condo we're in the middle of buying for you, it's going to cost you an extra $70,000 because you're American. And he had to scramble to get the transaction done. Otherwise, he would have had to walk away from his deposit because he couldn't come up with $70,000. Anecdotally, realtors will tell you a lot of people were in that situation. Not everybody was as lucky as him. A lot of people had to walk away from their deposits, and that there was a real ripple effect as well, because when one transaction collapsed, a transaction that was dependent upon that one also collapsed. So it really has left a big mess. As well, there's a lot of cynicism that, you know, those mythical rich offshore buyers that come in and, you know, buy $5 million homes, they're going to find a way to get around this. They're going to do it through a, you know, a relative or some sort of intermediary will take care of it for them. So everybody's just waiting for everything to shake down. And the real estate industry is saying 2-3 months down the road, we should see things settle a little bit.
Will some of the foreign buyers veering away from Vancouver be buying real estate in Western Washington?
I don't know why they wouldn't be. I mean, Vancouver is seen as a safe haven, and I know Seattle would be seen very much as the same thing. Toronto, in fact, is bracing for an influx of foreign buyers. But remember, this tax only affects Metro Vancouver. So the city of Victoria on Vancouver Island is also expecting to see an uptick. And the Fraser Valley, just east of the city here, not part of Metro Vancouver, they're already seeing house prices go up there as well. So it's got an impact right across the country.
Finally, Stephen, speaking of foreigners, you were invaded. Canada was invaded by more than 1,000 Americans over the weekend. What happened?
1,500 over-refreshed Americans, I would say. So this is the annual Port Huron Float Down that takes place the third week of August every year on the St. Clair River. So people set off in Port Huron, Michigan. They're in, you know, inner tubes and rafts and air mattresses and pretty much anything that floats. And they make the journey down the river south to, it's about 7.5 miles or 12 kilometers to Marysville, Michigan. The problem this time around was that the wind kicked up and it blew everybody toward the eastern shore, which is Canada, which is specifically Sarnia, Ontario. And I love this line from a Coast Guard officer. Peter Garapik was his name. He told the CBC there were Americans everywhere. And he said there was no chance for anything floating or people or inner tubes or anywhere to go but Canada. So the rescuers set out. Some people had to be treated for hypothermia who ended up in the water because it got pretty choppy out there. So the Ontario Provincial Police were in on it, the Canada Border Services Agency, Port Huron Police as well. 10 Sarnia transit buses were filled with Americans and made 19 trips across the border to get everybody back. I think the people of Sarnia were generally hospitable, although the mayor is a bit miffed about the rescue costs and the mess those Americans left behind.
Canada, I want to thank you for dealing so gently with our undocumented immigrants to you.
Bring it back to us in tourism dollars, won't you?
You truly are the nicest country in Upper North America, Stephen Quinn. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Stephen Quinn, host of CBC Radio's On the Coast, filling in for the Vancouver Sun's Vaughn Palmer this week. I'm Bill Radke. If you missed any of the show, go where you get your podcasts. Subscribe to The Record, Week in Review, KUOW News Features. Thanks for tuning in today.